Welcome to Business on the Brink, a production from iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. There is no magic potion to guarantee company success, but TSR sure seemed to have cast a spell on gamers with its release of Dungeons & Dragons.
From war to fantasy, they mixed imaginary worlds with real-time tactics and strategy to create a prize of a hobby.
But consumer concern, mixed with barbaric infighting and sneak thievery, not really, soon left TSR Incorporated and Gary Gygax Dragon.
Find out all about this company's epic quest on TSR On the Brink.
Hey everybody, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten.
And we've got another episode that is thanks to a listener request.
Yes, it's actually one of the first episode requests we ever got. We've been sitting on it a while. We're trying to balance out our geeky topics and our not geeky topics. And this one comes from Brandis Stoddard, who is a game guru, super awesome guy.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about him at the end of the episode. And as it turns out, the full story of TSR is a really, really big one.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though the company is just a few decades old, it's gone through a lot of changes since it first came into being in the early, well, mid-70s.
Yeah, and the request was actually for TSR Wizards of the Coast, because they do intertwine and it's very important their interactions together, but it is such a big story. We're going to have to break it out into two. We're focusing on the TSR side now, and then in our next episode, we'll focus on Wizards of the Coast.
Yeah, there'll be a little bit more TSR cleanup to do because it gets crazy, y'all.
It does.
So to give you a sense of our own personal connection with this topic, I played my first Dungeons and Dragons game session when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. My dad was enthusiastically trying to teach me, and I was enthusiastically young enough to not pay attention. But as a teenager, I became the dungeon master for a series of games. That's the person who runs the gaming sessions. And my friends would come over every couple of weeks, and we would play D&D. And this was with the first and second edition of the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons rule set.
Yeah, I first played D&D around 19, 20 years old. I had begun with LARPing and playing Magic the Gathering, which actually the music director at my church introduced me to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started playing D&D campaigns and other role-playing games with my LARPing friends.
So let's talk about the history of this. Well, also, for those of you who are not fully informed on what role-playing games are, we'll cover that as well. So in the beginning, where do we start?
All right. So TSR Incorporated, which as we said is known for Dungeons & Dragons, or D&D, was started in 1972 by Gary Gygax and Don Kay on about $1,000. And TSR stood for Tactical Studies Rules. In fact, that was the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't shortened to TSR yet. Brian Bloom and Dave Arneson joined into the company, Dave Arneson, just for a short period of time. He actually helped Gary Gygax create Dungeons & Dragons, but he wasn't brought into the company. And shortly after, Bloom added $2,000 into the company, invested it into the company's startup funds, and he eventually became CEO, and his brother would also become an early investor in the company.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they decided that they needed a company because Gary Gygax and Arneson had together come up with a rule set for this Dungeons & Dragons game. And they came up with the rules, but then they had to find a way of getting that rule set out to players.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So they needed to have a business in order to do that. It was, you know, this is pre-internet, or at least pre-public internet. So there was no way to reach out to people directly.
Yeah, and Arneson wasn't much of a business guy. Mm-hmm. So that's why it fell to Gygax and Kay.
Mm-hmm. So this, by the way, would be one of the very first role-playing games. In fact, arguably, you could say this was the first role-playing game. And it grew out of the wargaming hobby. And in wargaming, players control anything from huge armies to small squadrons in tactical battles. Typically, they're using miniatures and little miniature settings to represent, you know, battlegrounds. And they might use stuff like dice to help determine outcomes. The difference here is that Dungeons & Dragons would put players in charge of controlling just a single character, not a squad, not an army, not a battalion. Mm-hmm. And ideally, you would flesh that character out so that the character has his or her own personality, goals, motivations, etc.
Now, the person running the game would have multiple characters they were playing, mm-hmm. or NPCs. In 1974, the company came out with their first limited run of the game, 1,000 copies. They were all hand-assembled, and they all sold out.
Yeah, yeah. It was rapidly seen as something that gamers were actually eager to try out.
Yeah, and then in 1975, they changed the company's name to TSR Hobbies, which, honestly, I think it's better to shorten it down from Tactical Studies Rules, personally, after Kay passed away. And his share of this company passed to his wife. Mm-hmm. In March of that year, Gygax wrote a letter to another game designer and said, quote, "We will never allow TSR to become a company which is run by any outside group. That is, we may take others in as partners eventually, but we'll never seek any non-wargamer capitalization." But to do this, they needed a better structure to their company, and they didn't really have it. They were just working as a partnership.
Yeah, so it was very loosey-goosey. Like, they were kind of creating stuff on demand, and they didn't really have a good foundation to work from. So Gygax and Bloom incorporated TSR Hobbies. You know, it officially became TSR Hobbies Incorporated. Initially, they did it as an organization to handle mail orders of the game's rules. And then they were also looking at the possibility of opening up an actual physical brick-and-mortar style store in Wisconsin. But then they decided, let's repurpose this company, and we're going to use it to buy out the assets of the partnership. In other words, to actually buy the intellectual property that this partnership owned, mm-hmm. and that would free up Donna Kay, that was Kay's wife. She had been working with the company, but for no salary. In fact, no one had a salary because they weren't getting enough revenue regularly to pay salaries. And she wasn't really interested in working for a company that couldn't afford to pay her. And this gave them the opportunity to buy her out and to formalize the corporate structure.
That must have been a relief for her.
Yeah, yeah. And it was at this stage that Bloom and Gygax would receive shares in this new incorporated organization. It was privately held, so these aren't public shares. Mm-hmm. They're just it's
stock in the company.
Yeah, it's to show the extent of ownership of each party, each investor in the company. Gygax was awarded 150 shares. Bloom got 100. But then Melvin Bloom, the father of the Bloom boys, he would purchase 200 shares at $100 a piece. Brian purchased an additional 140 shares at that same price. So while the initial shares to Gygax and Bloom were awarded based on their work in the partnership, like how much time and effort and initial investment they had put into it, the additional shares that were issued would represent a $34,000 investment from the Bloom family. So the Blooms would own 440 shares collectively. Gygax only had 150, so he became a minority shareholder in the company, but he would still remain the president of that company.
I'm honestly kind of surprised that he let them do that.
It was probably not so much letting as a necessity because, again, that's where the investment money was coming from.
Yeah.
But as we will see, this would become the seed of a much bigger problem later on.
At this point in time, things seem to be going pretty well for TSR Hobbies. Runs of the game continue to sell out by the thousands, so they'd release a couple thousand, then a few more thousand, and then like 5,000 at a time, and they'd all sell out. And then all that while, they were also creating new campaigns for the game, new supplements, new modules, and releasing all of these new additions to the game. So you buy your core Dungeons & Dragons game, and then you buy all these additional adventures and classes and things and rules that you can integrate.
A trend that continues to this day and ends up becoming the lamentation of many a gamer.
But you see, I love it. I love it.
I mean, I ended up collecting a lot of them too. And if you were to put together, for example, all of my AD&D second edition stuff in one place, you're probably looking at around $500, $600 worth of supplements total.
Yeah. I think I was more of a third, fourth edition girl myself, although I have played original modules. So around 1976, their revenues were somewhere in the range of $300,000. Mm-hmm. And they started subcontracting out their printing and assembly to meet the demand that they were getting for this game.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, they were finally able to pay salaries to at least Gary Gygax and Brian Blum.
Yeah. Now, also in 1976, Brian Blum would ask his brother Kevin to help the company manage corporate finances. And Kevin initially served as the controller and treasurer for TSR Hobbies. In 1980, he would join Brian and Gary to become one of the three members of the board of directors. More on that later, too. Now, between 1975 and 1977, Gary Gygax and Brian Blum had opportunities to purchase up to 700 more shares as the company grew. And this was at that same price of $100 per share. And that would remain the same no matter how big the company grew. They had that option to purchase 700 more shares, but it would always be at that $100, even if the shares were valued higher than that at that point. Gradually, Gygax would own about a third of the company. Brian would always maintain a slight lead of 100 shares over Gygax for most of TSR Hobbies' existence. That would change a little bit later. Melvin, the father, would not purchase more shares, so he actually got left behind as both Gary Gygax and Brian Blum began to exercise these options. And gradually, the Blum family's ownership of the company would drop below 50% ownership, so they would no longer have controlling interest in the company. At that point, in fact, no party would own controlling interest. No one had 51% or more of the ownership. And that also will become important later on.
So in 1977, the game was actually divided out into two games, a basic version of D&D and advanced D&D. The basic version came with dice, and from what I understand, it was prepackaged modules and pre-generated characters and things like that.
Well, yeah, and you also had very limited character classes. For example, Elf was a class.
Yeah.
You could play an elf, and that was what – it wasn't just your character's race. It's what they were. Like, it's their occupation.
Yeah, and the advanced version had a monster manual with more monsters, classes, races, things like that that came with it. And you could play them or – play with them.
Or fight them.
Or fight them.
Yeah. It all depended on the scenario. And, like, obviously, some game masters would buy these pre-made modules, sometimes not even making any changes to them. Sometimes they would change them dramatically. And some people, like me, would design their own adventures but use the rules to define, you know, how those adventures actually work.
Yeah. And then in 1978, they actually got their brick and mortar. They moved out of Gary Gygax's basement into a space above a hobby shop in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Yep. So now we get to 1979, and this is an event that could have been a make-or-break moment for a young company. It involved the mysterious disappearance of a college student and a private investigator's hunch that placed the blame squarely on a little-known game called Dungeons & Dragons. We'll explain more in just a second, but first, let's take a quick break. Okay, so at Michigan State University, there was a student named James Dallas Egbert III, and he went missing, and it became a really big story. The family hired on a private eye to investigate this disappearance, and he found out that Egbert, like some of the other college students in the area, had played a game called Dungeons & Dragons. The investigator theorized, apparently with no actual evidence, that the game had somehow triggered a psychosis within Egbert and that he was most likely wandering through the steam tunnels beneath his college's campus, slaying imaginary monsters and questing for treasure. This, by the way, became the plot of a Tom Hanks movie in the early 80s.
What's the name of that movie, Jonathan?
Mazes and Monsters, I think.
Oh, okay.
I forget. It was like a made-for-TV movie. It is, by the way, absolutely terrible, and sometimes terrible in the most wonderful ways.
It seems like it would be a dicey at best movie, but it also seems like this theory that the investigator came up with is just very far-fetched.
Yeah, no, it was largely based on a deep misunderstanding of what a role-playing game is. There also had been reports that there were students on campus who would do the equivalent of LARPing, live-action role-playing. And so it was kind of a leap to go from, oh, these are people who are playing out pretend roles and having these adventures, to these are people who believe themselves to be these pretend roles.
I mean, as a LARPer currently, sorry people who that's too geeky for.
Yeah, it's just like they just lost all respect for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm also an actor, so it's a fun improv exercise at the very least. At least I don't, and the friends that I play with don't believe they're actually these characters.
Yeah.
It's make-believe. It's a fairy tale.
It also has to do with the fact that it's a game that involves magic. Mm-hmm. And so this was right at the very cusp of the satanic panic in the United States.
And so this got a lot of coverage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The media really focused on this story. I mean, it already is the disappearance of a student, which is that's enough to be a big story in itself. Then you had this potential connection to this obscure game that deals with demons and monsters and magic and wizards and sorcerers and things like that. It put D&D in a larger spotlight. And it would be the beginning of a long trend in which people would associate D&D with psychosis or cults or witchcraft and Satanism. And like I said, the Satanic Panic, which was a larger trend, it wasn't just about role-playing games. I mean, this involved like rock and roll music,
and TV,
movies, and, all this kind of stuff. Yeah, all these different things. People were thinking, oh, this is a manifestation of a growing cult of Satanists in the United States who have these very wicked plans for people. And we have to be on the lookout because they are out for our immortal souls. And yeah, this was a huge thing. Like, I grew up in this era, so for me, like, I'm like, this is also the age of things like chick tracks that would come out about Dungeons and Dragons and about how it would convince people to do terrible things. So, what was the result of all this?
Well, you know, I think the desired result was to get people to stop playing D&D, stop watching these movies, these TV shows, things like that. But actually, it kind of got this taboo cult following. People were like, what is this game that nobody wants me to play? And so it boosted their sales.
Yeah, it actually ended up being some of the best marketing that they could look for.
Yeah, and as for Egbert, he actually called up the investigator. It turns out he went to New Orleans.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more sad stuff about that story, but none of it actually connects to Dungeons & Dragons, and that's a different story for a different podcast.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you're interested in hearing about it, it is very sad. It does not have a happy ending. But as Ariel just said, it really doesn't have anything to do with the rest of our podcast. So rather than go down that rabbit hole, we will go back to talking about TSR. Now, one of the things that makes it hard to talk about TSR's early days is because they were a private company. And as a private company, they were not required to file detailed financial reports the way public companies have to every year. They essentially were just supposed to report things like revenues and costs so that, you know, the IRS knows how much taxes they get from the corporation. But the company claimed to have made around $2 million in sales revenue in 1979.
Well, that's not too shabby considering they started on like somewhere around $1,000 to $3,000.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was also an indication that this was a hobby on the rise, but that also would cause problems.
Yes, but it wasn't just a hobby on the rise in the States. It was also getting international appeal. So in 1980, they started an LTD in the UK to support their international demand.
Mm-hmm.
Also in 1980, a magazine called Inc., INC Incorporated, not
INK, the tattoo magazine.
Yeah, yeah. Named TSR one of the top 10 most profitable privately held companies. They've actually got a bunch of articles on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because TSR had submitted statements saying that they were making $16 million in sales or so, which is not bad.
Yeah, it means that from 1979 to 1980, they would have had 8 times the amount of sales revenue. That's an enormous amount of growth. It's like 5,000% growth. And you might say, well, that's incredible. And it might be a little too incredible. The Wall Street Journal would actually report in 1983 that those sales figures for 1980 were likely closer to $8.7 million.
Still, though.
It's still. But that's, you know, to go from 16 to 8, that's a, you know, you've reduced it by half. So, but it's still a pretty incredible number from 2 million to 8.7.
I wouldn't sneeze at it at all.
No, no. But it does make you question, why the heck is there such a huge discrepancy to go from 16 million to 8.7 million? Now, it's possible that it was all just honest mistakes. I mean, TSR was kind of, it was still not really a rigid corporate structure. Kevin Bloom was not like the the best accountant for that kind of job. I mean, this was something beyond what he had really worked toward before. Mm-hmm. So not saying he was bad, but rather that he was ill-suited for it.
Yeah, Gygax wasn't much better.
No, Gygax was a high school dropout.
And a game designer.
Yeah. Like, and so you had people who were very passionate about what they were doing, but they weren't business minded.
This actually caused problems. I read in the company there was a module that was written for the game called The Princess and the Silver Castle or something like that.
Yeah,
and
it was actually the Castle of the Silver Princess.
So, yeah, and it kind of they had a game developer write it. She said, don't let them touch my writing. The owners didn't really look at it. It went to the game developers. They put a bunch of in-jokes about how the company was being run and their dissatisfaction into it. And by the time it made it to print, it didn't make it to stores, but it made it to print. And then finally the owners saw it and were like, no, we can't.
Actually,
we can't publish this.
And it did make it to some stores, but it was there for all of one day.
Oh, okay.
On the day that it came out, it was recalled. And so all the stores were told to ship back their copies. A few got out into the wild. There are two versions of this module. There's one that has an orange cover. That's the original version that got scrapped after it initially came out. And then there's a green version that was completely rewritten. A large part of the problem was not just those in-jokes, but art that was, let's say, probably not entirely appropriate for the intended audience.
Exactly, especially not in this era of moral panic. Really, what I'm going to say is if they had had a better company structure and some R&D, maybe it wouldn't have even made it to stores or to print. In 1981, they licensed Dungeons & Dragons to Mattel. Mm-hmm. To make an electronic version of the game, and it sold out months before Christmas, which, as we all know, is the biggest toy and game season.
Mm-hmm.
And TSR, they didn't have to worry about supply. They just had to collect the royalties from it.
Yep.
It was not a bad deal.
Not a bad position to be in. Yeah, so now at this stage, they realized they were going to have to scale up because the demand was growing. Obviously, even if you look at the $8.7 million instead of $16 million in sales, that's a lot of demand. So this was not actually easy or well-documented at the time, largely because neither Gary Gygax nor Brian Bloom had any business management experience or knowledge. And according to an article written by John Peterson, this is an excellent article, by the way. It goes into very deep detail about what was happening at this time. It's called The Ambush at Sheridan Springs. It's published in Medium. I highly recommend you read this whole article. A lot of the information I pulled for this episode comes from that article. But according to him, financial reports from this time period were at best sporadic and not necessarily accurate. So you weren't getting frequent financial reports, and when you did get them, you couldn't be sure that they were reflective of reality.
Yeah, and this was actually made even more difficult because there were structural changes in the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Including one where they changed when the company's fiscal year began. So in 1981, they had a fiscal year that was only 9 months long.
Yeah. Yeah, that does make things much more complicated because also that looks like that's a huge impact on sales, right? Mm-hmm. If you only have 9 months of sales instead of a full 12 months, then it'll suddenly look like you weren't on your projected path for growth, right? Because but you have to keep in mind, well, that's because I have fewer months in the year because of the way we changed our structure. Also in 1981, Melvin Bloom would transfer his 200 shares to his son, Kevin. And at that point, Kevin Bloom owned around 205 shares, including the ones from Melvin. So he had only had five
shares
to start with. And this was a move that raised some eyebrows, actually, because it was thought that it was in violation of the shareholder agreement that, you know, maybe this was against the bylaws of the company, but they went ahead and did it anyway, and nobody put up enough stink to stop it.
I was going to say, knowing their management capabilities, it's possible that even if it were in the bylaws, there were giant loopholes they could have gotten away with it.
Yeah.
I haven't read them, so I'm not certain, but it doesn't seem implausible.
Yeah.
In 1982, they started translating their games into other languages, a whole bunch of them, including Finnish. Which is awesome because I like Finland.
I don't like it when things are written in Finnish because I didn't even get started.
Oh, Jonathan. And they were still growing. So this, you know, as we said, this moral panic wasn't affecting them despite their organizational issues.
Yeah.
They were still growing. And part of the reason for that is because adventure games and electronic games both were really gaining prominence in the market. Board games and card games and things like that were taking a slight decline. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just the way the
cycle was going.
The cycle was going and technology was advancing.
Like you could argue that right now we're in sort of maybe in the tail end of a board game renaissance.
Yeah.
But we saw over the last few years board games kind of increased in popularity, I think largely because you started to see people who wanted to find reasons to hang out with each other in mm-hmm. the same space at the same time.
As opposed to just on Facebook
yeah.
or Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
But another part of their success was that they didn't really have competition at this point in the role-playing game realm, largely due to the fact – I mean, they had war games, but they weren't really the same thing.
Yeah.
And other people who might want to compete with Dungeons & Dragons – and there's a lot of role-playing games out there now – Lord knows I've played more than I can count on both hands.
Sure.
But they had to write rules that people would want to learn and play. So once you already learned the rules for Dungeons & Dragons, which were and are a little complicated, 5th edition makes it a little easier.
Yeah, especially compared to 3.
Especially compared to 3. Oh, man, 3, you need a spreadsheet. But so it was hard for other companies and other people who wrote games to really get in there and get a market share because people already learned Dungeons & Dragons. They don't want to invest the time to learn something new.
Yeah. Also, TSR would release a few other games, not just Dungeons & Dragons. They were behind a Marvel role-playing game as mm-hmm. well. So they would release other role-playing games in other realms, and they weren't based on the same rule set either. So
yeah.
That, you know, TSR was not really in direct competition with itself because it was making games that were for different interests, like superheroes mm-hmm. versus fantasy. So, but they made sure to diversify a little bit in that realm.
Well, I mean, also, if I know I like the way Dungeons & Dragons plays and is written, I'm going to probably trust that company more for another game.
Mm-hmm.
Also, their manufacturing costs were low. Their overhead was low. They were able to make product to meet demand as opposed to having a whole bunch of supply and hoping people wanted it. They also had a line of credit, but it never really – that part of it, at least initially, didn't affect them. They were pretty wise on their spending at that point.
Yeah, that would change.
Yes.
So continuing this running theme of corporate governance confusion were some conflicting reports on how the company was actually being run. Doug Bloom – Can you guess who Doug Bloom was related to?
Ronald McDonald.
No, Brian, Kevin, and Melvin. Doug Bloom wrote an article for a magazine called Random Events, which I feel like could describe my life. But the article said that the president's office was held by 3 people. That would be Guy Gax and Brian and Kevin Bloom. And that all decisions were made unanimously. They had to be
wow.
a unanimous decision in order to move forward. If there was disagreement, they could not move forward. Guy Gax later disputed that description and said that he had ultimate authority for executive-level decisions as president. Board-level decisions were still done unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
But anything executive-level in the company, what he said ultimately fell to him, that Brian Bloom was senior executive officer and Kevin Bloom was the chief operating officer. So then, to make things more confusing, the company had a reorganization. So in 1982, it became known as the Year of 3 Presidents.
Golly.
Because Gary Gygax became president of TSR Hobbies Incorporated. Brian Bloom would become president of TSR Fun Group.
Sounds fun.
I know. I kind of wish I would be part of a fun group. And then Kevin Bloom became president of TSR Service Group. And as you can imagine, that didn't clear up things for anyone.
No.
Yeah. So despite all that confusion, the company was still doing really good business. And they acquired another gaming company called Simulations Publications Incorporated. And they also published a classic pulp fiction magazine called Amazing Stories, which Steven Spielberg did a TV series mm-hmm. based on in the 80s.
I think they're relaunching that.
Yeah, I believe we talked about that in an episode of a different show we used to do.
We did.
Yeah. Now, based on this booming business, they had every reason at that point, or at least they thought they had every reason to believe that things were just on the up and up and going to continue to rise. TSR valued each share of the company at $3,000. These would be the same shares that previously had been valued at 100.
100, yeah.
And you could still, if you were Gygax or Bloom, buy one of those 700 shares for $100 a piece, even though it was now valued at $3,000 otherwise. And again, a privately held company with most of the shares being held by those three executives.
Yeah. In 1983, they changed their name just to TSR Incorporated, so they took the hobbies out. And they added a fourth division.
Yep.
An entertainment division called Dungeons & Dragons Entertainment. And Gary Gygax was sent. Jonathan has in the notes here, some might say exiled. I read conflicting things. Some people are like, oh, he chose to go. Some people said he was sent. Some people said he was kicked out. He was sent to Hollywood to develop this division as the president of the division. And that's where we got the D&D cartoon.
Yeah. By the way, if you search online, have you seen this commercial that I'm referencing in this?
I haven't. I've seen the cartoon.
It's amazing. So there is a commercial. Renault released a car commercial in Brazil. So it's a Brazilian car commercial that features live actors. And as you watch it, you realize they are the characters from the D&D cartoon. And even the Dungeon Master makes an appearance in the commercial. It is pretty amazing.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah.
Now, going to Hollywood meant that Gygax had to leave the day-to-day operations of TSR to Kevin and Brian Bloom, who, you know, they had controlling stock of the company. And they were happy with that. They thought that they could do a much better job than Gary was doing.
Yeah. They felt that Gygax was being far too conservative. And trouble was a brewing because while they were doing all this, sales of the games were actually on the decline. The projected revenue for 1982 was $45 million. But when it was all said and done, the company only managed about half of that projected amount. And it's good because the market was contracting. It's the same sort of issue we've talked about with other things where you reach market penetration and market saturation, where the market, it's now, you've got as much of the product out there as people want.
Yeah.
And you can't just keep putting the same stuff out because everyone who wanted it already bought one.
And even if you're coming up with all these modules and additional adventures, people have to play through the first ones before they want to go out and buy new.
Yeah, so you either have to revise everything or you have to come up with something really innovative to drive more sales. But at the time, TSR was starting to find out that its bread and butter was getting a little stale.
Oh.
Yeah, and with that little CSI, like, yeah, moment, I think we can take a little break.
I need one.
Okay.
All right, so while Gary was in California to secure the whole cartoon thing, and by the way, he did get Orson Welles to agree to star in a D&D movie. I don't think that came to fruition.
No, the only D&D movie I could think of was the really bad one.
Yeah. Although Joe Manganiello,
he wants to do one.
He wants to do one. He's a big D&D fan. And while he was out there, he got word that Kevin and Brian Bloom were making a real big mess of the company.
Yeah, so they missed those revenue goals that I talked about, and they had to write off the acquisition of a needlework company. They had decided that they were going to diversify, and one of the things they bought was a needlework company because they were actually making money off of it initially.
So, like, just art projects that say there's no dungeon like home?
Kind of, yeah. Sort of, like, yeah. It's like if you don't want to play a paladin, you can do some needlework. But, yeah, it turned out that initial success wasn't something that was on a projected, like, the projected path was not accurate to what was actually happening. So they had to write off that acquisition. They also had to secure a $4 million loan with the American National Bank. And Kevin Bloom headed up that effort. He would later say, quote, "I was the best there was in the company, but I wasn't the right person," end quote. So there's some more foreshadowing. And this problem where they needed the cash, they didn't have it on hand. And ultimately, the deal was probably not the best one for the company. TSR's creditors also placed a demand on the company to bring on three outside financial experts to join the board of directors, which at that time were still just Gary Gygax and Brian and Kevin Bloom. So the Blooms got to choose because Gygax was out in California.
Yeah.
So the Blooms chose three new members from the Wisconsin area of businesses, and those three had no idea about the games industry. They essentially always voted along with the Blooms, so it really just added to the Blooms' voting power in the board of directors.
It's almost like they planned it that way.
Almost.
Almost. Well, Gary comes back. TSR is suffering from poor sales. They're over $1 million in debt. They're on the edge of insolvency. And beyond these kind of shifty decisions that the brothers are making and changes that they're making, they were doing some weird stuff. Like, apparently TSR had around 70 company cars.
Yeah.
I read one report that they were spending company money to, like, dredge up a shipwreck or something like that. They had too much inventory. They were overstaffed.
It sounded a lot like some of the more extravagant expenses you would hear about during the internet startup days.
Yeah.
Where you would have these dot-com companies that would get huge amounts of investment up front, and then they would blow all that money on these lavish offices and crazy parties and have very little to show for it afterward. That's kind of what it sounded like. But even though they were actually still producing games.
Yeah, it does sound that way. But they're still producing games, but the demand is just not there as much.
Yeah, yeah. And so this obviously is a situation that you can't have go on indefinitely. So the possibility of outside investors coming in and taking a majority share in the company arose. This was, again, against Gary Gygax's wishes. But the rest of the board wanted it to happen. Mm-hmm. However, while it initially looked like it could happen, the company later said it would undergo a financial restructuring process without outside resources. So why did this change? Why did it go from the company is going to bring in outside investors, they're going to get a majority share or at least a large share of the company? Why did that change? Well, it's because that's when Gygax decided to really jump in. He exercised his options to get
He leveled up.
Yeah, he did level up. He pinged. He got his additional shares. He exercised that option. So he bought more shares in the company. And his son Ernie owned shares of the company. And together, their collective shares represented 51.1% of the total ownership
of TSR. That's a narrow margin of control.
It's enough for a controlling interest. So because he had 51% control of the company, he could override the other board members' decisions. And he said, let's not do this deal. And the way I wrote it in my notes is that he passed his saving throw and mixed it.
I love that.
So the company downsized. They reduced their headcount down to 95 employees. They had been building steadily at that point.
At one point, they were up to 130.
Yeah.
Probably more before this.
So they came to the realization that their projections were not based in reality, that they were based on a fad, not a sustainable trend.
They had made these fictional projections before, and it seemed to go decently well, so.
Yeah, just that game didn't continue indefinitely. So by this time, the Blooms would no longer hold operational positions. Essentially, Gygax was like, all right, it's time for you guys to step down. But they still owned large number of shares in the company, so they remained on the board of directors.
Well, for a time.
Yes.
So with the Blooms out, Gary really needed somebody else to help manage the company, so he brought in Lorraine Williams in 1984 as a manager to help with financial stabilization. Jonathan, you have a note here that Williams' grandfather wrote some comic books?
Yeah. Yes, the original publisher of the Buck Rogers comic books. So the reason why I put that in there is because Williams came from money. She already had a pretty substantial amount of money at her disposal, and that's partly why Gary Gygax wanted her involvement, because she could invest in the company and help give it some much-needed financial support.
But also because he had worked with her brother in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Her brother was in the entertainment industry, and Gary had encountered him while working to get the D&D cartoon up and running.
Yeah. And, you know, it seemed like it was working,
mm-hmm.
but that was just a face value because Lorraine had planned out a little bit of a sabotage. I don't know if she meant it as a sabotage, but she certainly did some stuff in the shadows of business.
Yeah, here's where we get
under
to
the table.
Here's where we get to the real brink for TSR and for Gary Gygax in particular. And so pay attention, because this is an interesting series of events, or an unfortunate series of events if you prefer. So the Blooms wanted out. They were no longer in executive level positions, but They didn't want to get out without being fully compensated for the shares they had in their possession. They had an idea of what the valuation was for those shares, and they presented that to Gary Gygax. First of all, the company looked at potentially getting a loan from creditors to pay off this amount. But the creditors took a look at the amount that the Blooms were asking for, and they said, no, your company's not worth that. We're not going to give you a loan. For a buyback purpose, you can't do it this way. So then Gygax was thinking about maybe using his own money, but the Blooms' price was too high.
Yeah.
So there was this back and forth going on. But then you had Williams there, and so Williams and the Blooms met behind closed doors, and they met in advance of a big board meeting, and they concocted an idea. So Williams would put out a down payment of $70,000 to the Blooms. That was enough for their 700 shares that they could execute on.
Mm-hmm.
And with 300 shares of her own, and with the collection of the Blooms' shares of stock, she became the majority shareholder for TSR. Gygax, his shares fell below 50% because of the number that had been in circulation at that point. Williams had attracted enough of them. And she and Gary Gygax, while they had started off as being very friendly to one another, when they were working together, Williams became disenchanted with him pretty quickly. So,
do you think that might have been in part due to the Blooms' influence?
Possibly. I think it's also because Gygax himself was pretty conservative with his decisions. He wanted to focus more on the games approach. He was not as gung-ho on the diversification side. He did plan on not writing everything himself. He wasn't. Mm-hmm. He had already retired from that perspective of the business. But he didn't want to do some of the big moves that the Blooms and Williams wanted to do. So she put the screws to him, essentially, and the board of directors, with Williams as the kind of the motivating factor, forced Gygax out of the company.
That's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He actually tried to, once he found all this out, he tried to sue the sale of the stock shares and sue against it and keep it from happening. And he lost that fight. You know, Lorraine was CEO. They shelved a bunch of projects that Gary was currently working on.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but a lot of them.
I'm guessing that Orson Welles movie was one of them.
Probably. Yeah, and she did all this in 6 months.
Yeah, she had joined the company 6 months previously and at this point was now going to run the company.
Yeah, well, Gary resigned. He sold his remaining shares in the company. And in doing that, he lost the rights to a lot of the things that he had written and created.
Mm-hmm.
In an interview with Wired magazine before he passed away, because he passed away in 2008, he said that he was fed up and ready to leave at that point anyhow. He was just done with it. And over the next 10 years, Gary would go on to do other gaming things, and there would be legal battles between him and TSR over his new projects and the intellectual property that belonged to D&D and TSR. So all that's really unfortunate.
Yeah. Now, the company was dealing with the fallout for this battle for control at the executive level, as well as with other outside factors. And while TSR survived being on the brink of catastrophe for the time being, it was able to stay solvent at that time, it would turn out that another existential crisis was just a few years away. And we'll cover that one in the subsequent episode where we introduce Wizards of the Coast. But at the time, they had weathered a pretty dramatic storm. Like, ousting the founder of a company is a big, big deal.
It is. It seems to me that Gary would have been a lot better off if demand for his game had been smaller, if he had been able to stay a small,
like hobbyist kind
hobbyist
of thing.
Company. I mean, I'm personally glad that it grew much larger, or else I may never have, you know, played these games, which are an awful lot of fun.
Well, and I think that the rise of Dungeons and Dragons gave way to trends in mainstream entertainment that we're seeing today. Things like, I don't know that we would have the Marvel Cinematic Universe as it stands today without some of the groundwork that was laid by stuff like Dungeons and Dragons, which which kind of introduced more fantastical elements in entertainment.
Well, and like Tolkien had written the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit and all that and all these other books, but I'm guessing D&D probably helped encourage movie makers to make those stories into movies.
Yeah, and obviously you've seen lots of other fantasy films that definitely owe a lot to D&D. Now, I would say that the lesson to learn here, and it's one that Ariel and I are very familiar with, is that when you get a bunch of creative types together and they have great ideas for a business, whether it's games or it's theater or some other creative endeavor, that's fantastic. You definitely need those people, but you also really need people who know their stuff in business.
Yeah.
That if they had those business-minded individuals who had a deeper understanding of corporate structure and governance so that the company could perform as a company in a responsible and accountable way, then perhaps it would not have encountered these kind of challenges. But Ariel and I have both been part of groups that were full of creative individuals and lots of, you know, well-meaning intention, but that were, if they didn't fail, they struggled to succeed because we didn't have that business-oriented person there to say, like, your ideas are great, but it's my job to tell you which ones are realistic, which ones aren't, what it's going to take for us to achieve your vision, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is true. Well, I'm really excited to get into the next episode because the struggle was not over for Dungeons & Dragons at this point. But
No.
We're running short on time.
Yeah. The next brink moment would be the part where Wizards of the Coast come in, and that would not be the last brink moment. And, of course, not all brink moments are on the brink of disaster. Sometimes are on the brink of
success.
Of stratospheric success.
Yes.
So in our next episode, we will cover that module in the series, the campaign of Dungeons & Dragons to continue using the parlance.
Yeah.
But before we do that, you wanted to mention some stuff about our listener requests.
Yeah. So as I said, Brandis Stoddard requested this TSR Wizards of the Coast topic. And I know Brandis because I actually played a LARP that he wrote. So he does freelance game design and writing, but he also does a lot of blogging about gameplay and game theory and things like that. So we talked a lot about the business side of TSR and Dungeons & Dragons, and he writes about more than just Dungeons & Dragons. But if you want to explore that side of gaming, I suggest you check him out on Twitter. He is at Brandis Stoddard. That's BrandesStoddard. And you can also visit his website. That is www.brandisstoddard.com and check out some of the gameplay stuff that he's written.
Now, if people want to reach out like Brandis did and ask us to cover something, what email address should they use?
Well, they can email us at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
And if you want to check out more information about us and look at the archive of all of our past episodes, go to our website. That's thebrinkpodcast.show. You'll find all that there. And until next time, I have been Jonathan Strickland.
And I've been Ariel Kasten. Business on the Brink is a production of iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.